President Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Evident Footprints. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff. As you heard in the announcement, along with the music there, that's the Evident Footprints theme, in case you were wondering where that came from, original composition. We're now into December 1st on the East Coast, and points beyond are right on the cusp. So you're either in the time zone of December 1st or still stuck in November 30th, kind of the cusp of the next month. Anyway, I want to welcome you to the show tonight. We have a wonderful guest. He's going to be new to the people who listen on bbsradio.com. However, he has been a regular on my show on my prior network, regular every Tuesday. We're going to look to have him on every Friday. He is a wonderful guest, a wealth of information, and you're going to find his participation in the discussions that we enter into very, very enlightening, very interesting, and very fulfilling as well. Before I introduce him, I want to thank a few people for making a rant that I did in a piece that I published on my website regarding the November 28th Republican debate, and I use that word debate with reservation, publishing it on the internet. I put it on my website. Was sort of a cathartic rant about my perceptions of the debate and how I saw it as a psyops type of event. It was merely propaganda, and the so-called YouTube video submissions of questions for the candidates appeared to be very scripted, slanted towards certain candidates that the powers that be would like to present in the best light, to the detriment of the campaign of Ron Paul, who has not only outperformed all the other candidates in his fundraising capacity, especially within the last month, but also to try to stem the tide of an overwhelming grassroots popularity movement that is supporting his candidacy. And I want to reference the article in case you're interested in reading it. You can go to my website, which is directlightproductions.com. Look under news. You will find the article there. Republican debate was nothing but a propaganda exercise. Also, rents.com picked this article up. My friend Ken told me that he had submitted that. I want to give a shout-out to Ken, by the way. And Jeff Rents ran it. And so it's all over the world now. It is a discernment type of article where I just read right through. I just saw what CNN was actually doing to who we call the sheeple out there, the people that aren't really aware of what's going on. They don't keep up with all the bills that Congress is passing and all of these secret societies and their plans to create a new world order. So this was a means through which someone could just read this article and have a different perception of what actually occurred. I've gotten a ton of email on this article, so I'm grateful to everyone who has been moved by it, maybe had their eyes opened up, minds, and it's, if nothing else, it's reduced a lot of fear, and that's a positive thing. That's a good thing. So you could go to rents.com also and find the article. It's under the title Republican Debate Was Sheer Propaganda Exercise, and it's by me, so I look forward to more email from folks. Also, it is on the BBS Trusted News Trader page, and TNT Mad Dog put it up there today. To my surprise, he enjoyed it. So I want to thank everyone for acknowledging the effort. I spent more time on it than CNN actually did doctoring the videos for that broadcast. With that, I want to introduce tonight's guest now so we don't waste any more time. He is a scientist and inventor extraordinaire. He has most of his life been a student of Nikola Tesla. He is a teacher, an author, a lecturer. He's known throughout the world, not just for his inventions, but for his overwhelming knowledge. He is a very spiritual man and one of the most perceptive and honest people that I know on the planet. And I welcome to the show tonight, and I want to introduce him to all the listeners out there, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, how are you this evening?
I'm good, Don. Thank you very much for that flattering introduction. I hope I can live up to it.
Oh, just be yourself. That's all you got to do. That's all you've ever. That's all you've ever been.
That's true. That's true. Well, it's good to be here with you on the new show, and I appreciate the fact that we have a nice Friday slot, so I don't have to worry about early hour rising tomorrow.
Yeah, I have to tell the listeners, you did 2 and 3 hour shows. I mean, we were up until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, every week, and that takes a lot out of you, not to mention the preparation for that. So, you get a reprieve here now.
Well, it's okay. I enjoy the work.
Yes. Jim, I had invited you to the show, and I had asked you specifically if you would be so kind as to enlighten my listening audience with your knowledge about suppressed inventions. And so I'm going to turn the floor over to you and just let you have at it.
Well, all right, Don. I picked several categories which I thought would be the most interesting, not only because they cover a fairly wide spectrum of potential interests, but also because they represent inventors who have been tampered with and suppressed down through the years, not just any time recently or in the distant past, but shows a consistent effort to keep new technologies under the blanket for quite some time. And I would like to start off with a gentleman named John Worrell Keeley. I honestly don't remember when Keeley was doing his best work, but I know that it was in the 1860s or 1880s because he was just a little bit before Nikola Tesla. But the thing that was interesting about Keeley was that he was a musician and really had a feel for music and also the mathematics behind music. And he became particularly interested in the nature of the ether. Now, for the listeners who are not familiar with ether, it's a concept which has been pretty much strained out of the physical world in recent times, particularly as a result of Einstein's work. But in the early days of physics and engineering, the ether was looked upon as almost a mystical substance that pervaded all of space and even matter itself and was responsible for carrying certain types of vibrations through a vacuum, like light, for instance, but also for carrying mechanical vibrations through matter and sound waves, particularly longitudinal waves, through the air. And so Keeley became very enamored with this concept of the ether and began investigating the possibility of using sound as a means to decompose matter and bring it down to its absolute primary state, which, of course, is the ether itself, according to theory. And what's interesting about it is there's quite a few photographs and a considerable volume of information regarding Keeley's work in this regard. And also a lot of written material that has survived him. But to my knowledge, nobody's ever been able to reproduce some of his more dramatic effects. And one of the most interesting demonstrations that he ever gave, which I believe was done in Philadelphia, was that he actually set up a brick wall in his shop and brought in a cannon. And instead of packing the cannon with a gunpowder and a cannonball, as would be the normal approach, but what he did was he put the wadding and the cannonball in place, but instead of putting any charge in the cannon, he literally brought a very fine tube made of, I think it was three different metals, gold, silver, and platinum, and inserted it into the wick hole where the charge in the cannon is normally ignited. And this small tube was connected to a device which he called the disintegrator, and he put something like three or four drops of water into this disintegrator and began vibrating the device. And when he got up to a certain pitch, all of a sudden there was a huge explosion, and the cannonball literally left the cannon and blew a hole through the brick wall. And to my knowledge, that's nothing like that has ever been repeated. The interesting thing about it was Keeley had some investors, but he spent most of his time studying and trying to produce workable devices based on his theory. And his intention, of course, was to repower the world, as so many people have tried to do in so many different ways. And the next device that he came out with was a motor of sorts, which was a very, very strange-looking device. I have seen pictures of it. It was a large spherical contraption mounted in various gimbals and connected to an output shaft. And when this device was again connected to his disintegrator, it slowly began to rotate and produced usable mechanical output torque. Now, of course, there's been all kinds of theories about whether or not Keeley really accomplished these things or whether there was some kind of fraud involved. Unfortunately, I've never been able to get a hold of any information which clears up the picture one way or the other. But, Don, there's something really interesting about Keeley's work that you might want to comment on, and that is that he talked incessantly about the importance of understanding something called a triple covalent cord. And I don't know exactly what that is, but it has something to do with musical notes. And apparently, according to his theory, under proper control, this type of sound arrangement can exert enormous physical forces. And I know that you're very well acquainted with music. Do you have any ideas what he meant by this special triple chord?
Yes. I mean, we could go on for quite a long time with this one, but I will tell you that, first of all, let me just insert this here. In my studies of sound in speaker development, Keeley came up with a number of theories that are still honored today in audio speaker design, and in terms of using components and putting loads on these components to specify what frequencies will pass through, let's say the woofer or the mid-range or the tweeter, depending on the speaker's design and depending on the components and the actual enclosure. So he was very much into the physics and the electronics of the sound. The idea was, that he was striving for, was to produce the purest type of sound. Now, you have to consider that back then, we didn't have the components that we have right now. So he was experimenting with, let's say, the analog versions of you know, audio amplification, similar to the concept of a seashell, for example, or funnels and those types of devices. Now, to answer your question or to expound on that a little bit, chords produce harmonics, and there's an element of the harmonics that produce other energy patterns. Okay, if you have a fundamental tone, and let's say if you add a fifth to that and just play two tones, a root and a fifth, you get the third of the chord an octave higher, or it produces a tenth. So there is a mathematical equation. It's actually a sacred equation related to the Fibonacci series. And when you take chords and rearrange the intervals between the various notes, you change the chord qualities, and thus you change the harmonic vibrations. And the proper chords can produce healing, or they can alter the energy fields around the body. They can change the aura. I've done a lot of work in that area, so, you know, it would apply to that. And the triple, or the concept of the triple covalent chord, has to do with the harmonic structures. Now, we would have to get into a long discussion about all the different chord qualities and how those intervals change. But the basic principle was that if you build these chords in that manner, you are going to produce varying harmonics that either work with or against whatever you're trying to do. But it causes a change in energy patterns, definitely.
So in that respect, it's not that different from an electric motor, which uses the same kind of principle, except it's changing the relationship of electric and magnetic fields.
Yes, and of course, it's performing a different function.
But it could theoretically produce mechanical output power.
Yeah, and you know my feelings, you know, from past discussions privately or on the air that we've had about the importance of sound in healing.
Oh, absolutely.
That is just a different frequency of light. So, you know, these are just different usages or different manifestations of the same energy. Or translations, if you want to use that. I don't know if I answered your question, but...
Well, thank you for that input, because I wanted to recognize your expertise on that. And unfortunately, the way things turned out for Mr. Keeley was that after many years of hard labor, even though he did demonstrate quite a few of these devices to various people, there came a time when the investors were clamoring for a return on their money and wanted something immediately viable for commercialization. And apparently he wasn't ready for that, or he was underfunded. But anyway, unfortunately, the man shot himself rather than go through the disgrace of a bankruptcy. So considering his violent and abrupt ending, there's an awful lot of information that he took with him, which is very unfortunate. I know that there's a whole organization on the internet which effectively is known as KeeleyNet, and they've been trying for years to reconstruct all of the information that Keeley left behind and put it into some coherent form. But I don't believe anybody has ever succeeded in duplicating his most astounding achievements. And that's unfortunate, because nowadays the world could use this type of information. Now, in keeping with the theme of this presentation, that's such a long time ago, and the information is very sketchy. We don't really know if he was put under incredible duress by people who did not want this technology to come out, and finally he succumbed to the pressure, or whether there was another reason why he took his life. But considering the magnitude of his work and the possibilities that it represented, I thought it was a good way to start the ball rolling, Don.
Mm-hmm. Seems like every trailblazing type of scientist ends up in some tragic way, doesn't it?
Yeah, it seems that way. I'd like to think that that wasn't always true, but certainly looks that way. As a matter of fact, some of the other people I'm going to talk about also came to unfortunate ends, and that brings us to someone that I really admire, and I'm sure you know who that is, and that would be Dr. Nikola Tesla.
I thought you were going to say Ed Sullivan. Oh. Just kidding.
I don't think so.
Go ahead.
How did you ever dredge him up?
I don't know. It just seemed like something funny to say, so I said it.
Well, it was funny. Anyway, Tesla, of course, as you know, was a Serb, and he came to the United States around 1887, I believe. And he was, of course, already working in Europe for the Continental Edison Company and other institutions over there as an electrical engineer. And when he came to the United States, he had a letter of introduction, which actually put him in the good graces of Thomas Edison, who he actually admired initially. And Edison hired him, and they had a very interesting deal made that Tesla would redesign all of Edison's generators and motors up until that time, and he would do that for a salary of so many dollars per week, and at the end of the time period, if he succeeded in his task, he was going to be awarded a cash bonus of $50,000. And Tesla kept his end of the bargain. He completely redesigned and increased the efficiency of all of Tesla's turbines and DC motors and what have you. And at the end of that time period, when he informed Edison that he had accomplished the task that was set before him, he requested his payment of $50,000, whereupon Edison put his hand on his shoulder and said, "My dear young man, apparently you misunderstand the American sense of humor." And so he welched on the payment, and that was the beginning of a bad blood, let's put it that way, between the two inventors, which, of course, is somewhat unfortunate considering the way things went. But considering Tesla's high breeding and his European background, a handshake to him was probably as good as a 10-page written agreement would be today. And so he was really devastated by this. But nonetheless, he went on to find some people to back him with his own ideas instead of using his own money, which had been his initial intention. And he went on to produce hundreds of inventions. But, of course, the one that really changed the world and for which he is probably remembered the best is his polyphase electric motor. prior to Tesla's concept of the rotating magnetic field, the only kind of motors that were in existence, at least of the rotary variety, were DC motors with commutators and brushes and lots of sparks and lots of losses, and they had to be tuned and adjusted for the load that was put on them, etc., etc. And it's very interesting because Tesla confronted his own educators while he was still in school and asked about the problem of DC motors and said, "Why can't we use AC to drive an engine or to drive a motor?" And he was laughed right out of the classroom by the professors. They said, "Well, don't you realize that that's akin to a form of perpetual motion? Everybody knows that you can't do anything with AC. Only DC is viable as a propulsive force." And so Tesla humbly accepted that admonishment, but in later years he found a way to cause the rotation of a magnetic field by the use of these electric currents that people thought you couldn't use, and gave birth to an entirely new industry. And I want to point out, before we go any further with Tesla's work, that the entire world has been changed by the polyphase motor and generator and the associated transformers that make it all work. And I realize that most people probably have no inkling of how the world would have been had he not invented this device. But the plans that Thomas Edison had with DC would give you a pretty grim idea of what the world might have been like. He was going to put power plants for the generation of DC power on every other block or every few blocks in the whole city of New York, just to get his DC power around and distribute it to as many customers as possible. Now, you can just imagine if that trend had actually been embraced, that there would be a perpetual cloud of ash and soot hanging over New York City for many, many years, considering the outpouring of smoke and debris from these primitive generating stations. But because of Tesla's approach, AC, which can be transformed up and down, depending on the requirement, can be transmitted from many hundreds of miles without any appreciable loss. And so it radically changed the world, and it radically changed the way in which we use basic electric power. Now, most people attribute the development of radio to Marconi, simply because that's the way it's stated in the textbooks. But actually, the true inventor of radio was not Marconi. It was Nikola Tesla, and he actually has patents in his name, which predate any efforts by Marconi to attempt a commercialization of radio. And it just goes to show you that the man was extremely prolific in his ability to invent, had a very incredible understanding of the laws of nature, and put them to use in countless hundreds of ways. But the thing that I would like to concentrate on in terms of Tesla's work is the stuff that led to his downfall and led to the suppression of information which would have really benefited the world. In the early 1900s, Tesla was experimenting with wireless transmission of power. Now, this is a very interesting concept, and there are people who are trying to duplicate it today after all these years, but their approach is absolutely wrong with respect to what Tesla was doing. And it'll fail because, unfortunately, you cannot transmit magnetic energy through the air for any appreciable distance, even with resonance, and expect to have the delivery of large amounts of power. You might be able to light a light bulb or do something minuscule like that. But Tesla was talking about sending hundreds of thousands of horsepower around the entire world without the use of wires. And what's interesting about this concept is he was going to use the Earth itself as the transmission media, so that by sending power into the Earth and distributing it globally, there would be no transmission lines, no unnatural electromagnetic fields to contend with, and none of the problems that we have today. And on top of that, he was going to use as a source of power for this transmission effort the ionosphere of the planet itself, which, as you may know, is constantly charged by the solar wind from our neighborhood star, and represents tens of millions of horsepower in its overall electrical density. And he was going to tap into this and actually distribute that power globally for the benefit of mankind. Well, of course, there were people who just didn't like that idea. J.P. Morgan was one of them, and he had just finished creating the General Electric Company and was making use of Tesla's previous patents, which had initially been sold to George Westinghouse, which then later became public domain property. And so he wasn't about to stand by and have a radical departure from what he had just invested in and was already making hundreds of millions on. And so that idea was very, very quickly squashed. And Tesla was forced into bankruptcy, from which he really never recovered. But interesting enough, that wasn't the end of the story. He went on to do additional research, and in later years, as World War II approached, Tesla was already a pretty old man. He actually wrote the United States government a letter in which he offered them the design for a death ray, which would have been able to protect any country anywhere in the world from incoming missiles, airplanes, or any other type of weaponry, and to do so at an enormous distance from the main target. Now, whether this was taken seriously or not, I'm not sure, but it's an interesting coincidence that when Tesla was found dead in his hotel bedroom, his safe had already been rifled, and all of his secret papers and whatnot had been confiscated. So apparently someone had an interest in it. And whether they killed Tesla to get the papers or whether they just decided to take them when they realized he was dead is a matter of some debate. But in addition to the death ray, one of the most interesting things that Tesla was working on was a new type of flying machine. And from his description of it, it sounds very, very much like a modern UFO. There were no propellers, no wings, no visible form of motive power, and he claims that it could fly at incredible speeds, and it could park itself permanently in the air, even remaining stationary against a formidable wind. And all these things he was willing to give to the Earth to propel us into a totally new era of enlightenment and progress. But there were those who decided that that was not to be. And so those ideas were definitely suppressed, and they may have even have been stolen and put to use by secret organizations. And Don, you know exactly what I'm referring to. You have more knowledge on that than I do.
Yeah, if I could just interject something here for the listening audience, I did write a piece which ran 3 months in 3 parts in the Idaho Observer and is available on my website at directlightproductions.com, also at idaho-observer.com. You can read a piece that describes much of what Jim Murray is talking about right now, and I disclose who admitted to being a participant in the murder of Tesla, and through tracking the central banks and the goings on of the Bush family dealing with the Nazis and the communists in Russia, we were able to piece together a pretty compelling factual description of Tesla's demise and the theft of not only his money, but also many of his patents and inventions. And there's a very detailed description of that. Jim's purposely avoiding that to allow me to give some input, I think.
Well, also, you're much more familiar with it than I am.
Yeah. Well, Otto Skorzeny claimed in a what was referred to as a deathbed confession that he and Reinhard Galen actually murdered Tesla on June 6th, 1943, in his hotel in New York. And they had stolen his best inventions the day prior. They had quizzed him, interviewed him on this, and got hold of his best inventions. And then after Tesla died, even the FBI went in there and sort of mopped up whatever they could. But the most significant inventions had already been taken. So you have to trust that Otto Skorzeny was telling the truth and gave quite a bit of information. By the way, not to get us off track, Monday's show will feature the man who inspired me to do this research, and that's Eric O'Ryan. He will be our special guest, talking about his book, The Bush Connection, and his associations with Otto Skorzeny. So listeners are going to want to hear that show. It's going to be fantastic. Anyway, Jim, go ahead.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that. That's a point that needed some additional info that I didn't have, Don. But, you know, it's a funny thing the way the universe works and the way the planet works. Not all information gets lost just because some scoundrel doesn't want it to be applied for the benefit of humanity. And in later shows, maybe we'll talk about the fact that I have spent a lot of time in my own life and in my own career, you know, tracking down information that Tesla may have deliberately launched into the future through very unorthodox means, and which may yet prove to be extremely valuable to our present energy and power requirements here in the 21st century. So anyway, that's for another time.
Sure.
But before we leave the subject of Tesla and get into the next inventor, there's one little thing I would like to add. Tesla had a pet theory that was very, very interesting. He believed that radioactivity was actually caused by an influx of an unknown particle which came from outer space, probably from the energy of the sun, and which disturbed the nucleus of certain atoms and caused them to undergo a transmutation and find another level of stability by throwing off particles to obtain this new tranquility. And that is really why we have some radioactive elements in our periodic table. Now, I don't think that he had a whole lot of time to follow up on this, because I've read very deeply on the subject, and there's mention of it in two or three places, but I'm not so sure that he himself was in the position to investigate it as deeply as he wanted to. But why the reason I bring this up in closing the subject of Tesla is because the next gentleman I'm talking about is Dr. T. Henry Moray. And Moray started his public research in high-frequency power generation sometime in the 1920s. And that overlaps with Tesla's time period. And what's interesting about it is there's very persistent rumors that there was some degree of interaction between Tesla and Moray. And this could be possible. But the thing that seems to indicate it very strongly is the fact that what Moray was attempting to do was to harness an unknown form of radiation, which he had ways of detecting, which he claimed came from space, had a very high frequency, and was intricately associated with radioactivity. And what's interesting about it is that he was literally building circuits way before anybody was even remotely looking into this stuff. He was using vacuum tubes of his own design, which instead of having a heated cathode or a hot filament, it was actually making use of radioisotopes inside the tube as a form of ionization and amplification of power. And with these tubes and these special resonant circuits, what he was attempting to do, Don, was to receive these incoming rays at a very, very high frequency, probably in the gigahertz range, and then literally step that frequency down until it was at a more manageable level of about 60 or 100 cycles. And of course, in doing this, the amplitude of the wave would be enormously increased. So here he was taking these high frequency incoming rays, which he received with a special antenna, and he was using his circuitry to step the frequency down to a very manageable level and at the same time increase the amplitude so that he actually had a source of very usable power. And he gave incredible demonstrations, which are well recorded. I mean, this is not something that's a fly-by-night situation. There are pictures of him with his apparatus powering huge racks of lamps. There are affidavits which have been signed by engineers who came to marvel at the manner in which this device could power up some fairly significant loads with no apparent input except from an antenna. And the device that he was using was small enough to fit into a standard suitcase and was referred to as a powerhouse in a suitcase. And one particular example that I'm familiar with, he had a rack of some 3,600-watt bulbs, which he was lighting, strictly from this device in the suitcase, and one connection to ground and one connection to an antenna. And when he closed the switch leading to the antenna, within a few seconds, there was a large humming coming from his device, and all the lights glowed brilliantly. And he made an enormous impact with this demonstration. And, of course, it flew in the face of conventional wisdom so dramatically that people were not only astonished, but they just didn't really know how to respond to the whole thing. And what became of the device is really very unfortunate. He was demonstrating it at one point to a group of scientists from Bell Laboratories, of all places. And even though he told the guys that he was talking to in fairly plain English what he was doing, this one individual became very irate and literally took a sledgehammer and attempted to smash the device to see whether there were batteries or some hidden thing inside of it. And, of course, that was a very devastating situation because apparently he had put so much money into this last model that he didn't recover from that assault on his property. But what's interesting about it, and almost ironic, Don, is the fact that after all was said and done, and his invention was smashed and discredited, you know, by the newspaper articles and whatnot that followed, within months after that, the folks at Bell Labs suddenly came out with a transistor. And, of course, we all know that the world was radically changed by that. Now, there's no proof that I know of that these two situations are linked, but it's just an astounding coincidence.
It strikes me, I mean, that's an incredible story, but it strikes me that people were walking around with sledgehammers during those days.
Well, of course, I didn't get into all the details. I don't think they were walking around with sledgehammers. But
no,
when
just...
he brought the device to one of the Bell Lab shops to demonstrate this before a group of engineers, and apparently somebody had a sledgehammer, or maybe that was part of the plan all along.
Yeah,
I don't really
course.
Know.
Well, he was obviously stepping on the wrong toes, and someone probably had their own designs on his invention, I'm sure. Why else would someone do such a thing?
Yeah,
I don't know, but
if it were me, I think I would have lost it.
Yeah, it's the nature of what Tesla went through in the same way, although he may have not have experienced that type of violence other than the burning down of his lab in New York while he was out of town. You know, this is a repeated story. When you cannot meter something, or, you know, when you can't stick a meter on it and make money from it, they don't want it out there. So that's the underlying current to all of this information you're bringing forward.
Yes, and unfortunately, it's getting to the point where even these people who have gone out of their way to suppress all this information are eventually going to wish that they had it. Because,
yes.
As you well know, our oil-producing capacity has already peaked, and it's in decline. And once it's gone, we will be in a very interesting situation. Well there's one more person that we have time to cover here.
Sure, go ahead.
Which I think is interesting. I don't know too much about this guy, but I was really blown away by his patents when I read them. And I'm going to attempt to pronounce his last name. It's George Constancio. And he was famous for having developed a torque converter. This was a man who was an immigrant from Romania, came to Britain in 1910, and immediately began working in the automotive field, which apparently he was greatly attracted to. And he was just fascinated. Here's another guy like Keeley who was just fascinated with vibrations and with harmonics. And if you look at his patents, which are still available, you'll find that he has a system of levers, weights, and cogs and oscillating devices which are powered by the engine in the car, and which indirectly, I might add, provide torque to the wheels. And this entire assembly, which was self-regulating, has no hydraulics in it, has no need for a stick shift or anything of that sort, and simply changes its vibratory characteristics in tune with the speed of the engine. So the more you push on the gas pedal and the engine turns faster, this thing shifts automatically into higher modes of response and applies power to the rear wheels almost magically. Now, what's interesting about it, and I have to be honest with you, I don't know how it works. I mean, I have really tried to figure it out, and it's even though it's explained, you know, you can read it and you say, well, that sort of makes sense. But there's a big difference between honestly understanding what's behind the concept and reading about it, you know, in a secondhand kind of way. And so I really can't lay claim to a thorough understanding of this device. But I can tell you that he invented it in 1924. And by 1926, he had displayed automobiles parading around Paris and other European countries with such success and such elegance in their response and behavior that it attracted General Motors, and they acquired a license in 1926, but then they decided not to produce the device. And their excuse was that delivery trucks and cars with big engines like the Americans preferred are much more easily controlled by an inexpensive clutch and manual transmission assembly, which would keep the cost of the car down and allow people to enjoy direct control over their speed and their shifting and what have you. And I guess the public swallowed that. But it's interesting to note that in the 1926 version of his automobile, George could cruise at 40 miles per hour and get a range of 100 miles per gallon using his transmission system. And in my way of thinking, I believe that even then, that was the real reason for suppressing the device, because it was just too good. And
Rockefeller would not have sold as much oil.
Exactly.
That's the bottom line. I mean.
So, yeah. Very, very interesting technology, and worthy of study for anybody that's interested in trying to comprehend it. The last thing that's on my agenda would be to discuss a couple of my own experiences with this type of phenomenon.
Well, we got about 3 minutes here, so.
Oh, well, I didn't realize it was that tight.
Yeah.
But, I can just close by saying that I've spent a lot of years doing personal research in power generation and have personally experienced very, very enormous difficulties in being financed, in getting patents, making demonstrations to academia, and even in convincing engineers that there's something else that can be achieved. So the mindset is not fertile when it comes to new and radical ideas, even though we need them desperately. And I guess that's the bottom line, Don.
Yes. Well, I know, Jim, that you wanted to talk about your Dynaflux invention, we'll call it, your alternator, your generator. And I'm going to have you back again. I presume we're going to do this every week, although I don't want to be so presumptive or assumptive, but I know how much information you have to share with the world, and your invention should be looked at seriously by anyone out there who is interested in alternative ways of producing power. And, you know, this is a big concern. We want to dispel some of the myths. That's why we discussed this, but that would give us an opportunity to field some calls next week, too. You know, we do take calls on the show now.
Oh, that's good.
And so if I have your permission to do that next week, you know, if you would be so kind as to tell us about the Dynaflux and how you came to create it and what it can do. I really see it as a viable alternative, let's say, not to use a pun.
Well, I'm happy to do that, Don, and it is an interesting story, if nothing else. But the neat thing about it is it should give other investigators and inventors and engineers, you know, some stimulus to realize that there are other things that can be done. We're not at the end of the information chain by any stretch of the imagination.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been very educational, and I want to encourage folks out there to tune in again next week. Jim will be back with us on Evident Footprints. Jim, I know you have a book that's coming out soon. We've talked about this, and this would be the place also for the listeners to check into your artwork and that. And now that I have a website as well as a web page on the BBS radio site, you're going to get some exposure. And maybe next week we can talk also about some of the keepsakes that you're going to make available for the general public.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that, Don. No problem.
And I know that people, I'm going to get a ton of email just in response to the show. And so I look forward to next week. I want to thank you for coming on board with me here at bbsradio.com. And I look forward to next Friday when we will again be with our guest, Jim Murray. Jim, thanks so much for coming on the show tonight.
My pleasure, Don. You know that.
And I'll see you next week. If not
right.
Sooner. Be with us next week. Again, Monday, our special guest, Eric O'Ryan, will be with us on Evident Footprints. You don't want to miss that show. We're going to be talking about his book, The Book Bush Connection. Meantime, peace, love, and light, and we'll see you next week.